Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Victoria Lupashko, one of the hosts for the New Books Network. And today we are here with Dr. Chinmay Murali, Senior Research Fellow in the Department of Humanities and Social Sciences at the National Institute of Technology, Trichy, India. Hello, and welcome to our channel.
Hello, Victoria. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this wonderful opportunity. I'm really excited to talk about my book with you today.
I'm very excited too, and thank you for agreeing to talk to us about your new book, Infertility Comics and Graphic Medicine, written in collaboration with Dr. Satyaraj Satyaraj Venkatchan.
Yes, and you got it right. Satyaraj Venkatchan. Yes.
Perfect. And this book was published in 2021 by Routledge, and I'm very excited about it. But I'll ask you questions that pertain directly to the book. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your work and how you came to know it and how you came to it. So could you please tell us more about this project, how you got interested in infertility and its representation in graphic novels, graphic medicine, and medical humanities in general?
How I got my interest in the topic of my book, that is a representation of infertility in graphic medicine, I think is a good question to start with. As a student of English literature, I have always been fascinated by literary narratives on illness, such as Leo Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Illich and Albert Camus' The Plague. So as an undergraduate student, I also happen to enjoy reading theoretical ruminations on illness, such as Susan Sontag's seminal text on cancer representations, Illness as Metaphor. So right from my English bachelor's time, I have been curious about the intersections of illness, medicine, and literary studies in some sense. So I just want to tell you that the interest has always been there. And much later, when I joined the National Institute of Technology, Trichy, for my doctoral research, I was lucky enough to be mentored by Dr. Satyaraj Venkatchan. Dr. Venkatchan had a lot of interest in medical humanities, and it was he who introduced me to the exciting field of graphic medicine. In simple terms, graphic medicine is an emerging interdisciplinary field where the medium of comics intersects with the discourse of health and illness. Although initially I had very limited knowledge in comic studies, graphic medicine really piqued my interest. And I started reading autobiographical comics on illness, which are also called graphic pathographies. So alongside these narratives, I had also gone through the Graphic Medicine Manifesto, which in a sense inaugurated this field. And other key texts and articles on graphic medicine, narrative medicine, and health humanities. In fact, this practice allowed me to build a broader theoretical perspective on the visual representations of various illness experiences. Among various graphic medicine narratives I examined as part of my research, I was particularly moved by women's graphic memoirs on infertility. And one of the reasons why I was specifically drawn to these narratives was the cultural silence surrounding women's infertility. Infertility is mostly a taboo topic in mainstream discourses. And secondly, women are often forced to bear the cultural and medical burden of infertility, even though it is a gender-neutral health problem. So I was really fascinated by these memos, which I thought essentially foregrounded the gendered and tabooed nature of the author's lived experience of infertility. So I decided to focus my research on women's infertility memoirs and ended up writing my book based on my findings.
That's great. And I have to agree that, you know, the Graphic Medicine Manifesto, Pathographics, and, you know, all the books that came out in the last, let's say, 5 years have contributed to the establishment of the field. And, you know, I have put our interest, but, you know, also curiosity on a different scale. So, you know, I'm very happy to hear these titles as well, because, you know, I was interested as in them. And of course, I read them.
Great to know that.
Yeah. And so, you know, I wanted to start with the introduction chapter, right? Because in addition to positioning the book vis-a-vis the larger extant scholarship, you propose the term gynographics to denote a visual narrative that centers on female reproductive quandaries. And, you know, I was very, very interested in this term, and I would like to invite you to tell us more about this concept and your perspective on its theoretical work for medical or health humanities, as well as for literary and visual studies. So how do you define this field, subfield of graphic medicine? What's your take on it?
Well, that's an interesting question. I consider the term gynographics, which we proposed in the book's introduction, as one of the significant and original contributions of my work towards graphic medicine and health humanities scholarship. So apart from women's infertility memoirs, my research has identified a growing corpus of graphic medicine narratives that center on the quandaries of women's reproductive experiences, such as miscarriage, abortion, postpartum depression, menopause, and lesbian pregnancy. So among such narratives are Adrienne Shepherd's A Significant Loss, A.K.A. Summers' graphic memoir, Pregnant Butch, Lucy Knisley's Kid Gloves, and Therese Wong's Dear Scarlet, with the most recent addition being M.K. Servick's Eisner Award-winning anthology, Menopause, which I think you have already mentioned in your question. So I feel that these narratives are peculiar in that they address nuanced and often silenced issues centered on the complexities of female reproduction from a uniquely subjective and lived perspective. It's in this context that we introduced the term gynographics to denote these visual texts that center on female reproductive quandaries. Etymologically, the term evolves from gyno, which means relating to women or female reproduction, and graphics, which connotes images or visual representations. So the term gynographics may be conceived as an addition to critical vocabulary on female-centric literary or theoretical approaches with similar terminologies such as gynocriticism and gynocentrism. While gynocriticism was a term coined by feminist critic Elaine Showalter in the 1970s to foreground the need to have a uniquely female framework in the analysis of texts authored by women, the term gynocentrism has been in theoretical parlance as a term that encapsulates female-centric perspectives, or rather the advocacy of it. So though gynographics is related to the aforementioned terms, both gynocentrism and gynocriticism, in its attention on the female, it particularly focuses on a unique aspect of feminine experience, that is reproduction. So in a similar vein, as a subgenre of graphic medicine, gynographics is related, yet different from women's comics in general and comics and visual narratives that address other female health quandaries such as breast cancer and eating disorders. So today, now I firmly believe that the term is going to be a valuable addition to our critical vocabulary on graphic medicine, women's life writing, and finally the health humanities in general.
Absolutely, and especially, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that the term also creates a space where these taboos subjects, right, and where the silence, almost critical silence, can be broken, and then we can start talking about, these issues as they are. And of course, while the female reproductive system and, women are the center here, we also can include, right, all the other adjacent and intersectional aspects of reproduction, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yes. Did you want to say something?
No. I just wanted to say what you said is absolutely, it makes a lot of sense. Yes.
Perfect. And in chapter one, in a little bit more details, I think once you set the tone and you set the field up, right, with this term, that it's very important. In chapter one, entitled Visualizing Illness, Comics and Graphic Medicine, you establish the scope of this book in more detail, right? So we get into the meat of the argument, to say so, and you engage with the importance of graphic medicine. And here the chapter mentions that it focuses on the disruptive potential of graphic medicine in furthering the aims of health humanities and narrative medicine to develop a patient-centered and value-based discourse on medicine and healthcare. And that was a quote from page 10. So I was curious to know more about this disruptive capacity that graphic novels possess, in your opinion, and about their positioning as a genre in the field of literature and or narrative medicine.
I think this is an important question. As you rightly pointed out, one of the central arguments of my book is that graphic medicine has a unique potential to challenge the status quo in multiple ways. In fact, the field of graphic medicine is primarily inspired by the subversive legacy of the underground comics movement, which flourished in the 1960s following the comics censorship in the US. The comics underground has not only challenged the thematic orthodoxies, but also criticized the status quo through comics that boldly explore taboo subjects and socio-cultural issues. When we look at underground comics and graphic medicine in relation to each other, Justin Green's underground comics text, Binky Brown Meets the Holy Virgin Mary, which deals with his struggles with obsessive compulsive disorder and Catholic guilt, is often considered as a prototype of contemporary graphic medicine narratives. So inspired by this legacy of underground comics, graphic medicine foregrounds taboo themes and marginal perspectives of the patients, which are often neglected in the medical discourse. In fact, graphic medicine follows the central tenets of narrative medicine and therefore offers a creative space for patients to articulate the phenomenological and lived realities of illness and suffering, thereby according what we call a discursive significance to their marginal perspectives. So as I have noted elsewhere, the field of graphic medicine inaugurates a new politics of critique, challenge, and resistance in the field of healthcare, by dwelling upon a wide range of issues, including medical negligence, industrialization and commercialization of healthcare, patient identity, medical apathy, and doctor-patient relationship, among others.
Right. And I think this is even more important now, right, in the pandemic. And of course, once we surpass it, to talk about a doctor-patient relationship, to talk about unheard voices, to talk about, what happens when you don't have access to proper medical care, whether that's healthcare in general or mental health care or, whatever it is. And I think, having this theoretical background and having this place where we can talk about it both in visual form and in narrative form and bringing them together, it's actually very valuable. And it's becoming more and more valuable as we go through 21st century.
Yes, and since you mentioned the pandemic situation, it's also interesting to note that there is a growing corpus of graphic medicine narratives which discuss the theme of the impact of pandemic and related issues. And recently, an anthology of comics on the pandemic. And its various experiences was published, titled COVID Chronicles. And the anthology was published by Penn State University Press. So graphic medicine, of course, responds to the pandemic in its own way. And so it's also interesting to look at these narratives and how these narratives, in a sense, encapsulate our predicament experiencing or making sense of the pandemic and its varied experiential realities. Yes.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And, as you mentioned, Connie Chronicles, I just finished a book about women in the pandemic, specifically in Canada. So it's a journalistic type of book that, and it's the traditional narrative type. So it's not in visual form in any way, but it definitely brings right more items to the conversation about women's roles in such a planetary endeavor, and what happens with medical systems and the sort.
Of course it does. And it's also important to have such conversations going. So because the marginal communities and women are mostly affected by the pandemic, so that also throws up a wide range of topics or themes that could be discussed in relation to the experience of pandemic in relation to your sex, gender, and the communities from where you, your own community. So those are important questions that we need to address. Yes.
Sure, I absolutely agree. And, speaking of representation and, groups, whether minority groups, majority groups, and so on, in chapter 2, entitled Imagining the Barren, Cultural Representation of Women's Infertility, the chapter itself, it's very invested in recognizing the cultural role graphic memoirs on infertility play in destigmatizing female infertility. So here, I wanted to invite you to tell us more about how this process of doing away with stigma happens, especially in women's autobiographical narratives on infertility.
Yes, in the second chapter, my aim was to examine the politics of representation in the context of female infertility. And to this end, this chapter specifically scrutinizes diverse popular cultural texts spread across various media and genres, such as women's magazines, novels, advertisements, TV, melodramas, horror films, and reality TV shows. And through a detailed analysis of these pop culture texts, I argue that these mainstream representations of infertility reinforce dominant stereotypes and erroneous perceptions surrounding the problem. Finally, the chapter demonstrates how women's autobiographical narratives on infertility, specifically memoirs, generate what we call a counter discourse to the stigmatizing popular cultural representations of infertility. Such personal articulations wherein authors foreground their lived experience of infertility. Not only subvert dominant stereotypes, but also accord a cultural agency to the hitherto marginal perspectives on women's infertility. Now, coming to a question as to how women's autobiographical narratives counter existing stereotypes and stigma surrounding infertility, I think we need to pay closer attention to some of these texts. Take Paulette Alden's memoir, Crossing the Moon, for instance. So in this particular memoir, Alden, the author, not only recounts her long and painful period of mourning and coping with infertility, but also affirms how writing, along with the support of the family and other childless women, enable her to overcome the grief and to enjoy and appreciate life without children. And then Billy Borg's memoir, The Art of Waiting, on the other hand, offers diverse perspectives on infertility, ranging from tracing the depiction of infertility in literature and film to reporting the experience and reflections of those who navigated the crisis of infertility. Additionally, Box also documents the work of self-help groups, global online communities, infertility communities, and also organizations such as Resolve in alleviating the pain of infertile women. Interestingly, we also have memoirs such as Anita Jayadevan's Malicious Medicine, which depicts the experience of infertility in a non-Western cultural environment. Jayadevan's narrative is in fact a horrifying account of the author's experience of malpractice in an infertility clinic in India. In this particular memoir, Malicious Medicine, Jayadevan painfully recounts 8 harrowing years of her life undergoing treatment for infertility and the hurt and violence such an experience engendered in her. When you look at Jayadevan's memoir, it concludes with the author's plea for a code of law in India to regulate ART treatments so that other women are spared from the anguish and malpractice that she had to experience. Again, we have memoirs like Anne-Marie Scully's Motherhood Winked, which is sort of a social commentary on the impact of infertility on the sufferers and the role of the society in the modern digital age in both alleviating and aggravating their suffering. As such, the memoir offers coping strategies for those who go through infertility and its attendant socio-cultural challenges. Finally, we do have memoirs such as Elizabeth Catkin's Conceivability and Callie Mick's The Baby Binder, which are armed with a wealth of information on fertility science that the authors have gained through their personal experiences. So while Catkin's attempts to seek answers for her unexplained infertility enables her to present a comprehensive account of infertility treatments around the globe, mixed narrative, on the other hand, laments the insensitive public responses to women's reproductive failures. In essence, I argue that these memoirs, with a nuanced and subjective representation of infertility, perform a cultural work of removing the myths and stigma surrounding infertility and related reproductive disorders in women. In doing so, these personal articulations or renditions of infertility become what Thomas Kuser terms as quality of life writing, by which he means the body of life narratives, which has a great potential to demystify and destigmatize the conditions it recounts from the inside. So in the book, I also use theoretical insights from feminist critics like Elizabeth Wilson to contend that it is the liberative power of life writing as a feminist literary genre which allows these memoirs to challenge the stigma and stereotypes surrounding women's infertility.
Absolutely. And I think it does also create communities, right, around either writing or, you know, the illustrations or the practice, right, of illustrating and also, you know, of readership. So I think it engenders, right, this type of narratives engender a lot of small groups, and there's a lot of grassroots movement that aims, right, towards destigmatization and doing away with all these taboos and stigma that fall on women's bodies. So
yes, of course. But and building a community of sufferers, those who share the same condition, is an important aspect or one of the central concerns of graphic medicine as a movement. And we also have such communities created by authors and artists by sharing their stories in the visual forum of graphic medicine. And we always look forward to reading such experiences of people who share some kind of an experience of illness and the ways in which graphic medicine forms such communities of sufferers who can empathize or who can even share their stories. And with those stories, we can also, and those stories also perform the role of what you call instructional manuals, because those stories can inform people in different ways. And sharing the experience of one's suffering will be cathartic to the sufferer, but it also performs a different role. It informs others who go through similar conditions or similar experiences. So community building, of course, forms a central part of graphic medicine's mission. So that's very important in the context of graphic pathographies and people who share their stories of illness and suffering. Yes.
I absolutely agree. Yeah, and I think we get into the range of the third chapter, entitled "The Hegemonic Creations: Pronatalism and the Social Construction of Motherhood," and here the chapter draws on graphic narratives by Paula Knight, specifically on the memoir called "The Facts of Life." And here we see a discussion of socially constructed and gendered nature of motherhood. And, you know, I was very curious, and I totally agree with the argument about the ways in which you use Louise Althusser's and Ellen Peck's and Judith Sendovitz, just to name a few, theoretical positions in relation to Knight's memoir to talk about identity in relation, right, to motherhood and the constraints that maternal ideologies actually put on the artist, put on the mother to be, and so on.
Yes, this is in fact the first analytical chapter of the book where I close read Paula Knight's graphic memoir on infertility, The Facts of Life. So in her memoir, Knight not only illustrates her struggle with infertility and her subsequent psychic turmoil, but also challenges the normative structures of the maternal and the feminine, which deem her non-mother identity marginal and deviant. In doing so, I argue that Knight's narrative lays bare the patriarchal and misogynistic nature of pronatalist institutions and discourses that enervate and stigmatize the childless. And the theoretical framework which I used to analyze Knight's memoir draws primarily on Louis Althusser's concept of ideology and ideological state apparatus, and Ellen Peck and Judith Sendrovitz's theorization of pronatalism as an oppressive social force. In addition to this, I have also borrowed theoretical templates from feminists such as Simone de Beauvoir and Anne Snitter. And I think it would be interesting here to discuss how I use their theoretical positions in relation to Knight's memoir, or to make sense of Knight's visualization of her psychic and physical pain occasioned by infertility. So in their book, Pronatalism, The Myth of Mom and Apple Pie, Peck and Sendrovitz define pronatalism as any attitude or policy that is pro-birth, that encourages reproduction, and that exalts the role of parenthood. And they also frame pronatalism as an unquestioned social force, which has produced both the universal parenthood ideal and its attendant discriminations. In fact, pronatalism entwines womanhood and motherhood and mandates that women's fulfillment lies in her maternal role. According to Peck and Sendrovitz, pronatalist thought permeates mainstream discourses and institutions, which for them valorize motherhood and stigmatize women's non-mother identity. When we examine Knight's memoir, we also find that the author launches a strident critique of the pronatalist ideology for enforcing cultural otherhood on childless women like her. Knight also illustrates the social conditioning through which she internalized pronatal sentiments as a young girl. In the memoir, Knight specifically foregrounds the role of institutions and discourses, including family, education, and media in shaping pronatal subjectivities. It was in this context that I used Althusser's notion of ideology and its impact on individuals and societies. Ideology, according to Althusser, operates through what he terms ideological state apparatuses, such as educational institutions, religious organizations, family, and the media, which interpolate individuals as subjects. And drawing upon the Althusserian formulation of ideology, Judith Butler affirms that gender identities are constructed within such ostensibly apolitical social formations where the girl child is girled. That is the term she uses, girled, the girling of the girl child. So that happens in the family, that happens in educational institutions, religious organizations, and the media. So it's a complex process of social conditioning, which actually works through ideological apparatuses, including educational institutions and religious organization and so on, where this process of girling the girl child happens. So interestingly, Butler's notion of ideological interpolation in gender theory is partly inspired by Beauvoir's formulation that feminine is not a natural condition, but rather a form of becoming through cultural conditioning. To quote de Beauvoir, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. It is the civilization as a whole that produces this creature, which is described as feminine, unquote. So read through such a theoretical lens, Knight's narrative delineates the ideological interpolations within social formations that manipulate individuals into subjects of pronatalism. As such, I observe that the narrative illustrates the role of ideological apparatuses, including family and education, in a girl child's pronatalist subjectification. Citing the subjective experience of her upbringing in England, Knight arraigns the socio-cultural instruments of pronatalism that mediate and dominate her mental landscape in myriad ways. So these are some of the ways in which I use theoretical insights of Althusser, Peck, Sendrovitz, and others in my reading of Knight's visual memoir.
I think that is very, very important, and it's a still, you know, ongoing topic of talking about the girling of the girl child, right, and the ideological interpolation, of course, of the constraints of the maternal ideology and so on in many other societies as well, that emphasize, right, the pronatalist approach. So I found that very, very useful to talk about other societies as well, you know, outside of the UK or outside North America. So I would, you know, take the chapter to even further to analyze other
great instances. Great. Good to know that, yes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Eastern Europe, specifically Romania, it's pretty similar in that sense. But, you know, not to go too far in that argument. But, you know, I wanted to move to chapter 4 and to talk about the its title, right? The Infertile Body in the Clinic, Medicalization and Loss of Agency. Because specifically agency and medicalization are big, big topics when we're talking about our bodies. And I think the chapter here brings us into even more examples of graphic memoirs and expands the conversation by talking about the clinical encounter between the female body and the highly sanitized and patriarchally encoded space. Specifically the hospital or the fertility clinic. And I was thinking whether you could share with us some of the key moments in this chapter.
Of course. So in this particular chapter, I have attempted to delineate the perils of medicalization in the context of female infertility. So the focus of this particular chapter is on the lack of female agency in the clinical experience of infertility when the sufferer, the infertile woman, is reduced to the status of a docile body under an authoritative and penetrative medical eye. As you said, this chapter examines multiple texts, unlike the previous chapter, which focused more on Paula Knight's narrative, The Facts of Life. This chapter close reads texts such as Phoebe Potts, Goodex, Emily Steinberg's Broken Eggs, and it also includes Paula Knight's The Facts of Life in its analysis. And we also have Janelle Johnson's short comic on her infertility experience, titled Present Perfect. So as such, the chapter examines how these memoirs, using comics, subjectively foreground the hurt and estrangement they experience in a misogynist and technologized system of infertility care. In this context, I also argue that these graphic medicine narratives foreground nuanced issues such as loss of privacy, technological intrusion, and objectification that cause irreparable harm to women and jeopardize their identity as patients. Speaking of the theoretical framework of this chapter, I have extensively used insights from the feminist critique of medicine, specifically reproductive medicine, because the book is basically about infertility and women's reproductive experiences. So ideas of feminist scholars of medicine, such as Emily Martin, Deborah Steinberg, and Mary Daly, along with medical sociologists, including Michel Foucault and Deborah Lupton, have informed my readings of these narratives in this particular chapter in diverse ways. Here, when we look at the contemporary feminist critique of reproductive medicine, we find that it is centered primarily on the technological intrusion of women's bodies made possible by ARTs. Feminists note that ARTs, which means assisted reproductive technologies, under the guise of according women reproductive choice, make their reproductive lives available for medical manipulation. So as explained in this chapter, a similar critique of reproductive medicine could be found in infertility memoirs authored by women as well. These narratives, when you look at them carefully, foreground the author's dehumanizing and estranging encounters in the infertility clinic. And so utilizing comics for dances, these graphic texts accentuate the memoir's psychological turmoil of undergoing treatment, that too in a system of care that is unsympathetic and intrusive. While when we look at these particular, these texts, visual memoirs, Steinberg's narrative attempts a forthright critique of infertility care, which treats her like a fertility guinea pig. This is a metaphor which she uses to convey the kind of hurt or the kind of dehumanizing experience she had in the experience in the infertility clinic, and she compares herself to a guinea pig in a lab. So and we have other narratives like Johnson, General Johnson's short comic Present Perfect, which explores the ontology of hurt and estrangement that the treatments engender in the author. Parallels could be found in other narratives like Broken Eggs and Present Perfect, as both these narratives explore nuanced issues concerning infertility care, such as technological invasion of women's bodies and medical apathy. In a sense, the chapter argues that these authors lend a voice to the alienating experiences of women whose bodies and lives are exposed, excised, and manipulated by an authoritarian and misogynistic system of infertility care.
Indeed, you're right. And the ways in which the space, right, it's patriarchally encoded, you know, the gaze, right, that it's lands upon the women's bodies and so on. So all of this make for very impactful narratives. And of course the analysis in the chapter brings these details even more to the fore. So I was very very touched, right, by all of the stories. Going towards chapter five, I was very happy to see, the word alternatives and endurance and, traversing all of this in a way or another. And all of these are in the title of the chapter called Traversing Infertility, Endurance and Alternatives. And here we see a conversation between the notion of positive coping practices and all of the other concepts we've read about in the other chapters. So what are a few examples of such practices, positive coping practices in this case, and how do they contribute to the building of a non-mother identity?
It's great to know that you like the title of the chapter, Traversing Endurance and Alternatives. Finally, we have these terms, and as a reader, you enjoyed, you were relieved to find these terms. That's what I understand. Yes. So when we look at women who go through the experience of infertility, we realized that coping with the psychic or emotional challenges of infertility is a daunting task for most of them. This is because infertile women are alienated not only from their familiar socio-cultural landscapes, but also from their idealized notions of self-identity. So traversing the challenges of infertility demands tremendous effort from the sufferers, who are expected to refashion their identities to the practical and effective challenges of childlessness in a pronatal cultural landscape. So here comes the insignificance of positive coping mechanisms and practices, which I thought would enable childless women to successfully navigate the crisis of infertility and thereby positively embrace their non-mother identity. In such a context, the concept of resilience, through which the sufferers positively adapt to their infertile subjectivity, serves as an adequate method of coping. Therefore, the fifth chapter of the book examines the concept of resilience and coping in the context of female infertility. Specifically, the chapter close reads, two narratives, Poet's Good Eggs and Night's Facts of Life, to illustrate how the authors successfully navigate the psychic challenges of infertility through a positive coping practice. So when you look at these narratives, after going through a brief period of grief and mourning, both the authors successfully attempt a refashioning of their identity, also drawing on their values and goals to find hope and meaning in life and existence. It's an existential predicament to be a childless woman in a pronatal cultural landscape. So it requires a lot of energy, a lot of effort from the sufferer to navigate the crisis of childlessness. So both the artists recognize the significance of artistic creativity in their coping practice, and I found that very interesting. Both these women are cartoonists or illustrators or comics creators. So while Poets approaches her infertility in spiritual and creative terms, Knight affirms the role of art and the natural world in coming to terms with her non-mother identity. So Good Eggs reveals how the author draws impetus from her Jewish faith and its storytelling practices, which inspire her to narrate her own story of infertility, and she approaches her infertility in metaphysical terms. So there is a particular visual, there is a particular panel in Phoebe Potts' memoir, The Good Good Eggs, where we see Poets drawing her memoir. In that sense, the narrative is self-reflexive in some sense. So and we also have a religious appraisal of the situation, where she also uses her Jewish spirituality and its belief systems to come to terms with her predicament of childlessness. So with a religious reappraisal of childlessness, Poets perceives her journey of infertility as a source of spiritual growth and transformation. So that's one interesting aspect of illness narratives, that the experience of illness brings about a radical transformation in the individual. So he will be a changed person. So that is the philosophical role, or the philosophical significance, or the of illness experiences. It changes you as an individual. So you might look at life, you might look at your own identity in different ways. So the experience of illness can be transformative and can be useful at times. So Knight's narrative, when we look at Knight's narrative, attains special significance as it demonstrates the possibility of self-realization and personal growth in the process of coping with infertility. With an affirmation of her artistic self and a renewed interest in nature and wildlife, Knight not only sublimates her infertile predicament, but also refashions her identity and priorities in creative terms. In addition to that, Knight's creative adaptation of her infertile subjectivity through a dedicated pursuit of art and the natural world also signifies the possibilities of alternative mothering practices, which can create transformative changes in the sufferer by channeling her disappointment of childlessness into triumph. So we have two successful coping practices in these two narratives. While Potts uses a religious beliefs, spiritual practices, and artistic creativity as a coping method, Knight dedicates herself to art and ecology, which in a sense serves as a successful coping practice.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think it brings into conversation the use of right art and the approach toward and reapproachment towards nature, right, as coping mechanisms in many other illness instances, or you know, overcoming illness instances. And I thought it's a good way to get to it in chapter 5, the last chapter of the book. And you know, I have a lot of other questions, but I wanted to ask you if there's anything else that you would like to add here that we have not covered so far.
Nothing in particular. I think we have been able to discuss at length almost all the central concerns of the book. Yes.
Perfect. And, you know, I'm very curious. So I just wanted to ask you, what are your projects right now? What are your current projects that you're dedicating yourself to right now?
Speaking of my current projects, of course, I'm continuing my research on graphic medicine, now with a special focus on women's autobiographical comics. Right now, I'm working on a research article which examines gynographics as a unique mode of women's life writing. And I also have two forthcoming book chapters co-authored with Dr. Venkatesan. The first one, which examines the representation of queer motherhood in graphic medicine, will appear in University Press of Mississippi's LGBTQ Comic Studies Reader. And my second forthcoming publication is a chapter on graphic medicine and ecological consciousness, which will be a part of the Bloomsbury Handbook of Medical Environmental Humanity. So these are my current projects and my forthcoming publications.
Amazing. And I look forward to reading them, and I'll keep an eye out for the publications as they come out. Thank you very much for talking to us today, and I'll be tuned to hearing more from you and from your collaborators, and you know, hopefully to invite you back to a New Books Network interview.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for this opportunity. It was great talking to you today. And do read my forthcoming publications, and I hope we can continue the conversation later. So thank you. Thank you again for this wonderful opportunity. It was great talking to you today.
Thank you too.